Hello and welcome to Elita Dogma's Shades of Murder, a podcast where I will share and discuss tales of true crime, mysteries, and all things dark and macabre. If you eat, play, and dream in Shades of Murder like me, then welcome, my kindred spirits, to your new podcast home. If you enjoy the show, please remember to follow and subscribe, share, and rate so I can present more stories to you, and we can all embrace the allure of the darkness together. All of my contact information you can find in the episode description below. Please be forewarned that each episode contains specific and at times very graphic and disturbing details of the case and may not be intended for all audiences. Exorcisms and the belief in demonic possession are as old as any concept of religion. Records show that priests in ancient Mesopotamia performed exorcisms by throwing figures of demons that were handcrafted from wax into the fire as a metaphor for stripping away their dark hold over the afflicted. The Hindu Vedas, recorded between 1500 and 500 BC, were deities referred to as asuras, which they described as supernatural creatures, but which by today's definition would have been viewed as demons. It was written of how these asuras challenged the ways of the gods and sought to destroy human affairs. The ancient Greeks wrote of demonic beings that dwelled on the dark edges of humans and the other worlds. I wouldn't expect that many of us think about exorcisms happening in our modern world, or if they do, they are done by those who are extremists, such as members of a cult or by cultures that subscribe to supernatural beliefs and practices. However, this is not the case. And many Western civilizations in recent years have seen a resurgence in the belief in mysticism and the practice of exorcism. In particular, there has been a massive growth in the demand for exorcisms in the United States, with a recent Gallup poll indicating that as high as 50 to 70% of Americans believe in demonic possession. I guess this should not be that surprising, considering that most Americans identify as being Christian. And if one believes in a Christian God, then one has the tendency to believe in Satan or some kind of demonic deity too. However, the degree that which people believe that they or their loved ones are possessed by a dark force has reached frightening levels. The difference from decades, even centuries before, and today, is that most nations have a criminal justice system established, so that torture and murder of another human is not permitted, much less approved of under the guise of ridding that individual of demonic possession. When such actions are committed against another human being, especially if they are being inflicted against their own will, those involved will be prosecuted to the fullest extent of their country's laws and whatever the penalty under such legislation dictates. Holding the belief that the individual was possessed is not a reason law enforcement accepts, nor an argument any court or judge will agree allows for the intentional or unintentional killing of another person. Nowadays, the extremism of religion is faced with criminal laws, which are in direct conflict with one another. This is the story of Mara Chica Irina Cornich and the Tanaku exorcism that occurred in the 21st century. It is a shocking story because of what was done to this young woman who believed she was possessed by the devil and desperately needed help. It is also disturbing to realize how organized religion profoundly impacts others' perceptions and beliefs to the extent that they can justify and condone such brutal actions, especially in our modern age. Mara Chica Irina Cornich, who went by Irina, had many challenges in her life from the very beginning, which undoubtedly had a strong influence on her mental and psychological state, and why she was thus drawn to a spiritual path. In 1982, in the small country village of Perien, Western Moldova, Romania, Irina was born. Her family struggled to provide, and at only 2 years old, Irina's father killed himself in front of her. The story is that her father had been convicted of stealing chickens for his family, and had been sentenced to 4 years in prison. Instead of enduring what I can imagine would have been hideous, unbearable conditions inside a communist Romanian prison, He tragically took his own life instead. Her mother was a cruel and abusive alcoholic, so Irina and her brother Vasil were taken away and placed in an orphanage in the nearby town of Berlad. Imagine how horrible of an environment such a place would be for a vulnerable child during a time of extreme communism and poverty in Romania. The orphanage was spilling over with unwanted and impoverished children from all over the country. The home was ridden with filth and germs, with the worst imaginable resources. The children were beaten. They had very little food to eat, and some even died from malnutrition, starvation, and the abuse they suffered. It would not be until Irina turned 19 years old when a foster family brought her into their home that she would at last escape the hells of the orphanage. She worked incredibly hard and saved enough to reside in Germany for a while, where she was employed as a nanny for a few years. She decided to return to her native Romania in 2005. In early April 2005, priest Daniel Corogiono and the mother superior met the young Mericici Irina Cornici and her brother Vasil, who had arrived at the monastery to visit their friend, a young woman named Kitsa from the orphanage. Within only a few days, the young brother and sister decided that they also wanted to reside there. They were encouraged to come and live there at the monastery, since it had only been established in 2000, and the community was hoping to grow. Inspired by the spiritual path of her friend Kitsa, Irina decided to become a nun at the beautiful, isolated monastery. In the village of Tanaku, high up in the Carpathian Mountains, the monastery was perched on a high hill with very difficult access, far from any civilization. It was here that Irina pursued and led the most simple of lives. Without any electricity or running water, it was not terribly comfortable, but she had shelter, was no longer suffering from poverty, and was free from any violence. Then Irina began to behave in very disturbing ways. In very little time after she arrived in Tanaku, Irina felt the need to confess her sins, and she began to behave oddly. At first, it was relatively innocent, with her having what could only be described as giggling attacks, bordering on hysteria during Mass. She would claim afterwards to not remember doing this. Then she turned suddenly vulgar. Irina acted agitated and would impulsively say or make inappropriate gestures and insinuations toward the nuns of a sexual or otherwise inappropriate nature. At first, it was believed by Father Corogiono that her confession was not complete and that she was holding back her sins, which must be causing this strange behavior. When she confessed again, her behavior became even more unsettling, and her aggressiveness increased. Irina struck out violently at others and banged her head repeatedly against the wall. This continued to escalate into episodes of violence towards others and even toward the property. There were times when she had to be repressed and controlled, but Irina had no recollection of any of this happening to her. The nuns reached out for emergency services 3 different times, but no one would come to the monastery since they did not consider the situation a priority. Eventually, the situation became so severe that the nuns took it upon themselves to strap Irina down and transport her to emergency services. There she was held for 18 days in the psychiatric ward of the hospital, where she underwent intensive therapy. For several days, she hung between life and death, extremely agitated, violent, and tied down to the bed the entire time. Once Irina was released from the hospital, she told others that she heard evil voices around her because her thoughts had been sinful. The nuns, her brother Vasile, and the mother superior would visit her there while she remained hospitalized. It was Irina herself who suggested that she continue her treatment for what was diagnosed as schizophrenia back at the monastery instead of remaining at the psychiatric ward. I can't begin to imagine how terrified Irina was. Not only was she experiencing terror in her spirit and mind from what she believed was the devil, but she was tied down in a hospital, which undoubtedly had minimal resources, was uncomfortable, and likely run down, if not unsanitary. In this crisis, she wanted and chose to be with the people she saw as her family, who were waiting to help her back at the monastery. Unsurprisingly, the nuns supported this notion for Irina to leave as well. But what is surprising, and speaks volumes about their lack of qualified mental health care professionals in Romania at the time, is that the psychiatrist himself highly recommended the virtue of prayer as a form of therapy. Apparently, Irina was faring better after her dismissal from the psychiatric ward. At this time, she decided to return to her old home in the southwest area of Romania to gather some personal things she had left with her previous host family, including her savings. In Germany, when she had worked as a babysitter and a waitress, she had earned 3,700 euros, all which she had saved. However, when she arrived, there were only 500 euros left, which from what I gather may have been used, aka stolen, by her host family in her absence. Irina and her brother Vasile were both deeply bothered by what they perceived to be a sign of bad fate, and in response, decided to fast and pray throughout the night. This had the opposite effect it was hoped for, as Irina was badly agitated the following day. It was noted that the siblings had not received the blessing of the heiumen, which is the head of the monastery, to perform this penance, and so between this violation and the betrayal she had felt from her former host family, Irina was in terrible shape. Her sickness became worse than ever before. Just as depicted in infamous exorcist films, she would growl, snarl, and hiss. She suffered from numerous seizures and would completely lose control, striking out at herself and others. Irina believed that demons were overpowering her, and on various occasions, she begged the nuns to bind her and keep her repressed. Father Daniel Corrigiano turned to Irina's brother Vasile to determine what was best to help his sister. Vasile was ultimately faced with two choices. Either he should return Irina to the psychiatric ward immediately, or she could receive prayers of deliverance. To this, her brother elected to obtain the monastery's help with his sister's crisis. In order for Irina to be taken to the church for the rite to be performed, it was deemed necessary for her to be attached to a stretcher. The stretcher was crafted from two vertical boards and one horizontal, resembling a makeshift cross. Irina lay strapped to the stretcher that eerily resembled a crucifix, her mouth gagged with a towel, and was left inside a dark, musty room at the monastery. Over 3 days she remained there. Father Corrigiano attempted to explain their actions. He claimed that Irina had become violent, had refused any form of nourishment they offered her, and would only accept the holy water they sprinkled on her. He believed that they were left with no other choice but to restrain her. The gag had been placed in her mouth to silence the spillage of obscenity and profanity that the demon spoke through her. The young woman suffered immensely, dying slowly over these 3 days, dehydrated and suffocating. When the 3 days finally passed, Irina appeared to be making signs of a recovery. She was released from her binding to the cross and left alone inside her room for several days. She was more aware of herself and her surroundings, and even accepted a little bit of food and drink, after several days of having neither. Suddenly, though, Irina fainted, and she would not wake back up. The nuns called the paramedics, and Irina was rushed to the hospital. But she never made it there and died on the way. An official autopsy would reveal that the cause of death was a combination of the severe dehydration, exhaustion, and asphyxiation she had suffered from the towel she had been gagged with. The father and the four nuns who assisted in the rite now face charges of aggravated murder in Irina's death after prosecutors heard 11 hours of testimony. In the criminal justice system in Romania, a conviction for this degree of murder could prospectively send them to prison for up to 25 years. Father Daniel Corogiono directly blamed the pressure of the media for the charges, claiming that he and the nuns were utterly innocent of any wrongdoing. The desolate country location of the Tanaku Monastery had become overrun with eager journalists who demonized the father and the nuns. The degree of public outcry against them and the overwhelming media presence led the defense counsel to request a change of venue. There was an escalated sense of mistrust and fear toward the priest and the once highly revered monastery by their fellow neighbors. One man, a 52-year-old retired welder who had epileptic episodes, expressed how he feared that if he went to the monastery for help, they would also crucify him. Initially, it was believed that the priest, Daniel Corogiono, and the four nuns whose actions directly led to young Irina's demise would be charged with manslaughter. However, within 1 week of media attention and the pressure from society for justice, local prosecutors were replaced by those from the highest court in Romania, the Prosecutor's Office of the High Court of Cassation and Justice, who pursued charges of intentional homicide. All five of the monastery members were detained for 29 days in jail before the trial began, but they were released upon its renewal since keeping them there was not justified. Then, by the end of the investigation in March 2006, the charges were lessened from intentional homicide to deprivation of liberty followed by the death of the victim. There were many who sided with Father Daniel Corogiono and the nuns, believing that the prosecutors were pressured by the media and concerned community to pursue criminal charges. A lawyer and member of Romania's parliament, Aurelian Pavlescu, pointed out that aggravated murder is defined as an intentional cause of death with the use of sadism, and that by definition, the actions of the father and nuns did not fit this description. In their minds, they believed they were providing the necessary healing to help Irina. Extended relatives of Irina strongly disagreed that she was not intentionally harmed by the father and the monastery. They pointed out the fact that Irina was hospitalized only days after joining the convent and that her body after the rites of exorcism was disfigured. Her aunt, Onosori Antohi, said that Irina had unexplained markings on her ankles, hands, and stomach. Irina's great uncle, George Antohi, expressed what a lovely girl she had been, that what was done to his niece was incredibly cruel, and that her offenders deserved to suffer the same fate. The courtroom was filled with haters and supporters alike. The defendants were convicted for holding Irina against her will, actions the court determined had led to Irina's untimely and totally preventable death. Father Daniel Corogiono was sentenced to 7 years in jail. Nun Nicoleta Acolanu was given 8 years in prison, and the other three nuns who were complicit in the crime, Adina Copraga, Elena Otel, and Somona Bodanias, were all handed down 5-year sentences. Daniel Corogiono appealed to Romania's Supreme Court, but his attempts failed, and they upheld his conviction. He vowed upon his release from jail that he would build a monastery in Irina's name, but upon his arrival in the eastern commune of Zapodini, where Daniel had hoped to establish one, he was met with outrage by the people of the village. They made it perfectly clear that he was not welcome there and successfully ran him out. Now he lives out his days isolated inside a hut deep within the forests of Romania. The church shut down the convent and chained up its gates. The Orthodox Church has not placed any of its support behind Father Daniel and the nuns, whose exorcism ritual was deemed to be, in a quote, abominable. In fact, Father Daniel had been ordained a priest, although he had never completed his studies in theology. The Tanaku Convent had been established via a private donation in 2001 and had never been sanctified by the church. That is, it had never been declared a holy site. Father Daniel Corrojono, due in part to the botched exorcism that led to a young nun's death, and most likely the terrible reflection he and his actions made upon the already scathed church, was subsequently abolished from priesthood. This directly led the church to impose stricter guidelines for those who enter monasteries, including psychological tests. All four nuns who were involved in the rite were also excluded from the church. Now, whatever your thoughts may be toward the priest and the nuns, what their intentions were and what their behavior led to, I think it is important to point out how for people who literally have given themselves over to God and sacrificed everything to serve the church, being forbidden to continue along this spiritual path must have been the most severe punishment imaginable to them. In order to better understand this story, its victim and the offenders, it is critical to view it through the cultural framework of its time and place. During the time of Nicolae Ceaușescu's brutal communist regime in Romania, national mysticism, monasticism, and religion in general were heavily repressed, especially during the late 1950s and early 60s, which saw many monasteries shut down. Orthodox mysticism was viewed as a core element of nationalist ideology, and once communism fell, and with it came a rise in social inequality and economic progression, there was also a return to the countryside and to the ways of monasticism. It also established parameters on the ages at which individuals, except for graduates of theology, were permitted to enter a monastery. For women, it was set at 55 years old, and 60 years for men. This created a widespread ban on youth pursuing becoming monks and nuns. When these restrictions were lifted, monasteries began to seduce society in a whole new way, with pilgrimages and religion-based tourists seeing a huge increase during the 1990s and 2000s. By 2005, the number of monasteries increased 4 times, with 500 locations being established. Romania has the most compact network of monastic members in comparison to other regional orthodoxies, with 12,855 priests, 2,866 monks, and 5,224 nuns serving the church as of 2004. During the mid to later part of the 1990s, there were multiple guides on the directives of confession being published. These guides outline the categories of sinners with everyday people, having an inventory of 201 sins, priests having 224, their wives the same, and monks and nuns who were considered the spiritual elite with 438 sins to confess to. In other words, the higher up the divinity pyramid you climb, the lesser allowances of sin one has, and the more one must confess and repent. Once communist rule fell in Romania, the monastic tradition of hesychast mysticism found a new audience in its younger generations. Hesychasm involves the use of deep silence through incessant praying to form a divine connection to God. It is based upon transcendence through stillness and prayer. According to hesychasm, there are 2 kinds of consciousness: ego-centered, to which we are dominated by attachment to our emotional and intellectual states, senses, and our imagination. The second is the ego-transcendent, which involves detachment from these states. The ultimate goal for this practitioner is a union with God, which is achieved through 3 steps. The first is dispassion, which involves the detachment from one's emotions and senses. The second step is stillness, which is the detachment from the intellect and imagination. And the last phase is deification, also known as the abiding state of illumination. novices of hesychasm are first encouraged to isolate themselves from the world and disconnect themselves from their passions. These practices can include fasting, also known as food deprivation or moderation, sleep deprivation, alongside continuous prayer, and the use of prostrations, which is the activity of bending the knees and lying flat face down on the ground in an act of reverence or submission, and of course the practice of silence or minimal verbal communication. As a result of these practices, hesychasm mystics are granted experiences believed to be distributed by God and are viewed as part of their journey to their ultimate connection with God. The first is hesychia, which is described as a state of detached awareness, inner tranquility, and focus. There are spiritual gifts that may be experienced by the practitioner and can include the gift of healing disease, proclamation or prophecy, which in this sense means the transmission of information from the ego transcendent consciousness as it relates to the present, past, or future, and revelation, which is a type of transsensory awareness. They experience dikresis, or discernment of spirits, which is the ability to distinguish between thoughts originating from the ego versus the ego transcendent consciousness, and the fifth is spiritual wisdom. The divine light is described as being a literal, supersensible light that gives them knowledge that transcends beyond space, time, and reason. The last gift is agape, or theocentric love. Along this journey to their connection with God, their progress is measured by increased love and decreased fear. However, it is noted by theologists that for some, this degree of ego detachment can be overwhelming and even dangerous. Some practitioners, if they are not prepared for the experience, may find that instead of a high level of transcendence, they are faced with a trap of psychosis, seem to be possessed, and wander in their madness. It is important to understand what this unique spiritual path entailed, since the priest at the helm of this exorcism was a devout believer and practitioner of hesychasm mysticism. Apparently, for many, even though he was only 29 years old, Father Daniel Corrojono transcended his age and experience. He was known for his spiritual charisma, and young women flocked to his monastery, becoming utterly devoted to him and his ways. Father Corrojono did not exactly fit into the traditional molding of a priest. Only a decade prior, he was known for being a local soccer player in Vusili, a town near Tanaku. In his own words, he admitted that he was not a strong student, and after unsuccessfully applying to a university in Bucharest to pursue a degree in sports or law, he opted instead for theology studies at a small university in the poverty-stricken Northeast. Within that same year, he was approached by a businessman to assist him in constructing a humble monastery in the hills. A local bishop ordained Daniel Corrojono under the premise that he would still pursue his religious studies, but he never did. Not long after, Father Corrojono made a name for himself in the church, and not in a good way. His beliefs and style were rebellious and not in sync with the diocese, whose leaders found his approach to be disturbing. He even was given a written warning to change his ways, but he was too stubborn to listen or care. He strictly forbade those who were not true believers of the Orthodox Church to enter the monastery and placed half a dozen signs around the entrance with warnings to visitors. They included signs that mandated that men were not permitted inside after 4 p.m. and women were forbidden inside if they were in pants or their heads were uncovered. Yet another sign reads, and I quote, "This is God's house. Hear the angels sing." He held service several times throughout the day and even held Mass in the middle of the night. The villagers near Tanaku were also drawn in by the mystical, long-haired, red-bearded young man, and he had many overly enthusiastic, high-praising followers. It was also known that Father Corrojono had a way with the demons, and he showcased his penchant for demonic banishment in flamboyant displays during services, where he would cite prayers for exorcism on command. His arrogance was noted to be a sign of his youth, lack of humility, and absence of any real training as a spiritual leader. I have no doubt that since he and the nuns were all practitioners of hesychasm mysticism, their mindsets and perceptions of what was going on with Irina were heavily altered by this extreme form of Orthodox Christianity. In return, this must have had a profound impact on the way they viewed Irina's behavior and how the rite was performed. I can only speculate on this, of course, but based on the spiritual practice of hesychasm mysticism, the priest and the nuns were most likely in an almost trance-like state themselves while performing this spiritual ritual. Their reality was not grounded in any logical thought, so the concept of endangering Irina probably never entered their minds. They saw a spiritual crisis in which only prayer, isolation, and even binding of the inflicted could release the demon from this innocent vessel, and therefore save Irina's soul. Within the tragedy of the Tanaku exorcism, the powers of the church over the resources for mental health care have been placed in the spotlight. It was reported that after the persistence of the nuns' request to place Irina in the hands of the monastery for spiritual treatment, she was released from the care of the hospital before schedule. The lack of mental health care and their penchant for believing in religious therapy over psychiatric care in Romania directly led to the circumstances that resulted in Irina's death. However, it is interesting to acknowledge that there was a real possibility that Irina's cause of death was from the high dose of adrenaline given to her by the paramedics. The coroner, Dan Georgiou, who performed Irina's autopsy, agreed that her ultimate cause of death was an adrenaline overdose, and he didn't understand why the judge never took this fact under consideration. The defendant, Daniel Corrojono, himself strongly stood by his belief that the only thing he did wrong was call the ambulance, which led to her death, not the exorcism, and that she had been in the last stage and would have recovered. The real darkness, and that which is the penultimate villain in this story, is Romania's healthcare system. It was in such a deplorable state that such minimal services were provided that many impoverished Christians relied on the healing powers of the church rather than seeking medical treatment or legitimate healthcare. Instead of being taken care of by qualified medical professionals who would diagnose and treat their illnesses, they turn to men who claim to be exorcists, although some never officially were, to solve their physical and mental health problems. That is, rather than deal with underfunded hospitals and incompetent healthcare professionals. From what I have researched, the tragedy of Tanaku, which resulted in a young woman's death who was suffering immensely from a serious mental illness, has made a direct impact on the mental health care system in Romania. In 2005, the College of Psychologists in Romania, also known as CPR, was established, which any practicing psychotherapist in Romania must be accredited by. They have specific guidelines and procedures that now oversee the profession. Although there is still a mental illness stigma in the country, there have been many organizations and resources established since the time of the Tanaku tragedy, so that they no longer ignore or minimize mental illness in the country, and they continue to strive to combat this ongoing health crisis. That doesn't mean that exorcisms on a global scale, in particular people in countries that have some of the most advanced technology and healthcare systems in the world, continue to increase their desire to seek out the aid of the church. As I mentioned in the opening of this episode, the rite of exorcism has a history as old as any recorded civilization. as a practice seeped in religious healing. An exorcism's purpose is to rid someone of a disorder, whether it is social, psychological, or a material condition that has arisen from one or more supernatural entities. This typically concerns an individual person, but can also be applicable to objects and places that are believed to be possessed. The Ritual Romanum, which was written in 1614, is still applicable to the practice of exorcism today. It contains the rules of procedures and is the penultimate guideline for the identification and treatment of the possessed. What is considered to be the official exorcist handbook, Exorcisms and Related Supplications, which holds the specific rites of exorcism, was translated into English by the U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops in 2017. From its initial standardization of the Exorcism Directive in 1614 up until this year, it was available exclusively in Latin. The International Association of Exorcists was established and co-founded by six priests in 1994, including the illustrious Gabriele Amorth, also known as the Pope's Exorcist, the title character in the same-named movie that recently came out, and by the way, is an excellent film. Father Amorth led the church in more exorcists than any other priest, claiming that he performed more than 60,000 rites, up until he died at the age of 91 in 2016. In 2014, Pope Francis formally recognized the association, which has 400 exorcists, including Orthodox, Protestant, and of course, Catholic. Although science and technology have transformed our societies within the last few centuries, especially in the Western world, exorcisms and the belief in demons have only increased. In the last decade alone, the number of exorcists for the Catholic Church has increased from fewer than 15 in 2011 to over 100 officiated exorcists in 2017. As of 2023, it is estimated that there are somewhere between 125 and 150. The Church themselves do not record any official statistics, or even how many official exorcists or exorcisms have been performed. Exorcists throughout the United States, however, have spoken of an ever-increasing demand for the ancient practice. One particular exorcist, Father Vincent Lampert, who is the official exorcist for the Archdiocese of Indianapolis, alleged in an interview that he received as high as 1,700 requests for an exorcism to be performed in 2018 alone. Some researchers believe there is a direct correlation between the amount of demonic possession being portrayed in film and television and the increase in demand for exorcisms. Others have suggested that the church, in particular the Catholic Church, has experienced such a massive decline in members, no doubt thanks in large part to their concealment of child abuse at the hands of their clergymen, that they have become more open to marketing this side of religion. Besides, they are one of the largest businesses on the planet, and they are always looking for a way to increase attendance. You may be wondering, are all of these requests for divine intervention via an exorcist granted? The simple answer is no, since not only would the priests who conduct exorcisms be fully consumed by the sheer amount of requests, but for many reasons it is critical that they only be performed on those who are in genuine need of salvation. The first step in gauging who may be inflicted with a legitimate case of demonic possession is referred to as discernment. This boils down to an individual being placed under psychiatric evaluation by a mental health care professional to determine whether their experiences and symptoms can be identified and explained by a mental health condition. It has been reported that the high majority of cases end at this step. Most individuals who believe they are possessed are suffering from some kind of psychiatric condition. in particular schizophrenia or dissociative personality disorder, to which many have already been diagnosed prior and who have recently stopped taking their medication. Now, if a psychiatric or physical exam and analysis of the individual does not indicate a clear diagnosis of the problem, which has culminated in the person's symptoms, the priest will begin to view the possibility of demonic possession through a more serious perspective. The church has declared that there are classic signs of demonic possession, which include speaking in a language that the person has never learned, physical strength that surpasses the person's age or physical condition, knowledge of information deemed to be secretive by the church, and an extreme aversion to God and what are considered to be sacred objects, such as the crucifix and holy water. When a ritual commences, traditionally, the exorcist will be accompanied by several other people who assist in prayer and sprinkle holy water upon the possessed individual. The exorcist then makes the sign of the cross and kneels before the afflicted person, reciting the litany of the saints in scripture. The demonic entity or entities are next addressed, in which the priest sets ground rules which they are to comply with. If they are called upon, they are to show themselves, and if asked to identify who they are to provide the exorcist with their name. And when they are dismissed, they shall leave the body of the possessed. Why would a demon hypothetically abide by these rules? It is believed by the Catholic doctrine that since the exorcist is working with the absolute authority of God in Christ, the demons must comply. The exorcist will traditionally cite to the demon, and I quote, "I cast you out, unclean spirit, along with every satanic power of the enemy, every specter from hell, and all your fell companions." A prayer usually signals the end of the ritual, with a promise to continue with more. Although there are very few people who have been believed by the church to have been truly possessed by a demon, those who are have been taken very seriously, with six or more additional exorcisms performed on them before the priest feels confident that the demons have been completely abolished. What lures a demon to latch onto a human vessel? It is believed by many religions that a demon needs a doorway to enter the other world. Catholic exorcists who were interviewed on the matter pointed out that a history of abuse appears to be the single greatest factor, in particular, victims of sexual abuse. Father Gary Thomas reported that as high as 80% of the individuals who sought him out with a request for an exorcism were survivors of sexual abuse. It is believed by these priests that sexual abuse can create a wound on the soul to such a severe degree that it helps to foster the conditions necessary for someone to become vulnerable to becoming a victim of demonic possession. This finding is quite ironic, since there have been so many reports of sexual abuse allegations made against Catholic priests. Now, pertaining to Irina's case, we know that she was traumatized at a very young age by witnessing her father's suicide and suffering physical and emotional abuse at the hands of her mother and then later by those at the orphanage. It is not much of a stretch to think she may have also been a victim of sexual abuse. Even if she never had been, the young woman had endured a lifetime of psychological, emotional, and physical abuse by those who were supposed to take care of her. So it is not difficult to understand how she was broken inside, mentally vulnerable to being taken over by another force. Now, whether that force manifested itself into schizophrenia or demonic possession, it exhibited a dark hold over her in spirit, mind, and body. Personally, I find the hypothetical connection between abuse and the vulnerability of being possessed to be compelling. the vast majority of known serial killers were victims of abuse, whether it was sexual abuse, physical, emotional, or some combination. There has been a strong correlation found between the abuse they suffered and what triggered and motivated their crimes. There are murderers with multiple or single victims who have claimed to have been possessed by a dark force who were also victims of abuse. It does make you wonder if there could be some truth in this connection. I have hypothesized this concept myself more than once after watching a true crime documentary or even a horror film. Not necessarily the connection between abuse and demonic possession, but I have discussed the notion of how some deeds done by others are so horrible, so inconceivable, that maybe the person had been taken over by a dark force. What if, hypothetically, these victims of severe abuse, especially child sexual abuse, were so wounded that they were vulnerable to being targeted vessels of demonic possession? Now, I know this may seem preposterous and sound asinine to some people, but the correlation between abuse and drawing in the devil or some kind of dark force is an interesting concept. For some murderers, especially those who committed acts that were so horrific, so barbarous, and so beyond the idea of evil, who were victims of horrendous abuse themselves, perhaps, just maybe, because of what they endured, they were not in control of their vile actions, since they were no longer in power over their soul. I am not suggesting this to be true, or that I even necessarily believe in demonic possession, but again, I do find it an interesting hypothetical connection to ponder upon. The majority of the exorcists who were interviewed also believed that due to the renewal of interest in magic, witchcraft, divination, and communicating with the dead, there has been a significant increase in demonic possession. Catholicism teaches that engagement and interaction with any realms of the occult open up the space that may be inhabited by demons, and that such beliefs and practices can become the catalyst for dark forces. Exorcists have even spread into social media, with one particular priest, 71-year-old Monsignor Stephen Rossetti, who created his own TikTok channel several years ago now, to help steer the youth toward the church and away from the dark temptations of witchcraft and folkism, which he noticed have been trending online. He specifically uses terms like Satan and the devil to lure in this demographic to turn them back to God. Whether you believe in this idea is determined by what someone perceives as the occult, what that inhabits and doesn't. The term occult simply means secret, which could encompass a vast array of beliefs and practices that an individual or organized sect of believers hold close to their sleeves and don't want anyone to have knowledge of. This definition could easily define the motives, intentions, and practices exhibited by the Catholic Church, so I find it quite ironic that they judge and villainize the occult. What are your thoughts on the Tanuku exorcism? Do you believe that Daniel Corojono and the nuns received just punishment for their actions, which directly led to a young woman's death? Do you think they were negligent and abusive, or they did what they deemed to be necessary to save her jeopardized soul? Thank you so much for listening. I appreciate each and every one of you, and I am beyond thrilled to be your host. Until next time, stay safe and watch out for shades of murder happening in the streets next door, and especially inside your own home. Alita Dogma's Shades of Murder was created, written, researched, and edited by Alita Dogma. Music courtesy of Pixabay.